Where's Fielder?
He's gone to the dogs.
Welcome to the Gone to the Dogs podcast, your friend, and you are my friend. Steve Fielder here with my compadre, my cohort in crime, my accomplice, Mr. Corey Groover.
What's up, Corey? Howdy, everybody. How's everybody doing today?
Everybody's good, I can tell. They're under the sound of our voice, so we know they're not up to any trouble or anything like that. They're kind of a captive audience, I imagine, either behind the wheel of a vehicle or a forklift in a warehouse or a tractor out on. It's a little early to be getting the fields ready for planting, I'd say. In most of the country, down here, I'm sure, that goes on year-round. But anyway, it's good to have everyone with us again. And this is Monday morning as we're introducing this episode, our normal slot. I think this thing airs at about 3 o'clock in the morning. For those of you maybe just coming in from hunting on Sunday night, man, you're going to have a rough Monday. But
you're going to have to be sleeping during your lunch breaks.
That's right. Oh, boy. Here comes the stories. Ninth grade, Mrs. Kaiser, algebra 1.
No thanks.
Right after lunch.
Ooh.
I fell asleep every day. She always asked me, Stephen, are you ill? Because I had my head down on the desk. Oh, algebra was not my friend.
No, same here.
Yeah. Well, Corey, we did a podcast together last week, and man, I think people are liking the combo here of the old and the new, the beauty and the beast.
I don't want to know which one is which.
Well, I don't think there's any doubt about that. But anyway, it was fun. It went well. And
I think we
might be onto something here.
Yeah, I think we're moving in a very positive direction with this. And hopefully people don't mind me learning along the way. Steve's my mentor, so we're going to try to give it our best shot.
Yeah, in some things that may be true, just due to age and experience, but certainly not in terms of ability and love for the sport and a solid background. So our goal here, folks, is to bring you as much good information as we can each week, while squeezing in a little entertainment along the way, share with us some of our stories, our laughs. I'm working on a graphic, Corey. I didn't tell you about this.
Uh-oh.
But I named the episode last week, Stephen Corey Hot Stove, you know, Gone to the Dogs Hot Stove with Stephen Corey. There we go. And in the baseball world, hot stove means just the discussions all around the sport of baseball, taken back from the days when people gathered at the old country store and sat around and talked about the ball players. So we're going to kind of take that approach with this podcast. So I'm going to have Melissa and Ash there do a graphic for us. That's going to show one of those old pot-bellied stoves with a dog laying there. And I've got a great photo of Fever if she can use it. If not, Corey, I may have to come to you to get a good photo. But at any rate, we're going to work that up a little bit and see where that goes. And we may change our logo on Spotify and W and all those kind of things. But anyway, that's a little thing that I'm working on. How's that sound to you?
Oh, that sounds great. As long as I don't have to cut the wood for the stove, then we can do whatever you want.
A guy told me back in West Virginia, he said, man, I was like 18 years old before I knew my name wasn't Get Wood. Yeah, that's a dad joke. Sorry.
Well,
about
speaking
that.
Speaking of plots, how is Fever doing?
Fever is doing great, but Fever's not having the best of luck here lately. The last couple, two or three hunts that he's been in, little dog's been hunting hard, been getting split treed with the coon, gets beat maybe on a strike because the other dog, you know, it's supposed to be competition. It's not supposed to be easy. And, you know, he's encountering other dogs that are good dogs too. And they're getting split treed with the coon. And if they might beat him a little bit on the strike, and excuse me. But so that was one cast he had there. He hunted, Mark said he hunted real good, I think, in the late round. Got split again real deep, couldn't find his coon. Now, that this time of year, when you say can't find the coon, I'm more of the school of thought that maybe it's not there. He didn't tell me if it was a den or whatever, but he's been doing everything we want him to do, but he's just not having much luck right now. He still needs three wins to be grand night. So we kind of hoped to have had those before we went to the American Plot Association Days, which is coming up the weekend that we're recording this. And by the time you're listening to this, folks, the American Plot Days will have passed. And I had announced that I would be going. Since that time, I've had a change in plans and will not be going to American Plot.
What a shame.
Yeah, I was really looking forward to it, getting together with all the guys. It's a hunt where it's a campfire hunt. You know, the hunters all gather around the campfires at night, and stories roll, and it's just a great fellowship time. But it is primarily bear hunters that attend that event. But anyway, Fever's doing all right. I can't complain.
Yeah, we brought up Fever. If I'm not mistaken, Fever is doing pretty good in the PKC breed race right now, which is an accomplishment.
My years at PKC, you know, we didn't have a lot of plots that participated. Although, by golly, in 1990, we had one that won the PKC World Championship, and that was the Buckeye Bud Dog owned by John and Rita Walkup, who are from my home state of West Virginia, but they lived in Ohio at that time, I believe. So, you know, to accomplish that, there are a couple of breeds. I don't think a Redbone has won a world hunt, has it? I think they have won the Purina Award. I know that happened, but I'm not sure that a red dog, and I don't think a blue dog has ever won the UKC World Hunt.
I think with red bones, that's a bone of contention, because if there's a dog that you'll commonly hear referred to as a world champion name, I believe it's Timber Chopping Dan.
Mm-hmm.
And I've heard that he's won the ACHA world, but then again, I've heard that he was just a high scoring red bone at the ACHA world. So I don't know that.
Well, our listeners, it would be a great time for you to get on the Coon Hunting Conversations page on Facebook and set us straight, and we'll be glad to acknowledge you and your answer on this podcast. But, well, you know, way back in the day, UKC referred to Autumn Oaks as the world championship. Did you know that, Corey?
I didn't even know that.
Yeah, they did, and that was before 1978 when they did decide to have a separate world championship. And that's goes to show you how old I am, because I was a field rep that very first year. Represented Ohio and West Virginia and Virginia, Eastern Tennessee, and some of those areas. Actually, my very first RQE that I worked was way up in New York. And I wrote about it in my book. It was kind of a neat story about the club made maple syrup for me. But there I go down a rabbit trail again. You're supposed to head me off, man. Whip my butt and send me back the other way.
Well, so anyways, I know that I I recently saw some of the breed standings that are currently out there for PKC, and I saw Fever at the top of the plot list. So congratulations to you on far. That's great that you and Mark have been able to do that with them.
Yeah, 100% kudos to Mark Miller. Mark and I, through Providence, got together when I had that puppy from Bill Schindiger and needed somebody to help him be all he could be. And Mark stepped up and said he always wanted to plot. He's had some really good walker dogs down through the years and still has a good one or two. But yeah, that old pup's been a lot of fun. He was born in October. He was 2 years old back in October. So we've had a lot of fun with him. And we finished second last year in the PKC breed race. And so we're going to give it a shot this year. I don't imagine that we'll win it overall, because we're not going to travel all over the country to try to do it. But yeah, old Fever. Catch the fever.
Catch the right fever. Don't just go out there and try to get sick.
That's right. That's right.
Well, I got to spend my weekend with a bunch of PKC dogs. Our weekend at our local coon club, the Mercer County Coon Hunters Association in my hometown, we actually played host to the Pennsylvania PKC state championship this weekend, and that was a lot of fun. Actually, I wasn't participating in the event myself. I was simply serving as a guide and helping as a kitchen aid and all that kind of stuff, but we had a really good turnout. It was a really cool event.
Yeah, well, you know, PKC's a little different breed of cat. I learned that when I went to work for PKC back in 1998, after all those years at UKC. And I figured out right away that there's a different culture there. And I don't think it's as different nowadays, perhaps, as it was back then. But it was a pretty much us and them kind of mentality between the two registries back in that day. And of course, UKC has always had the prestige of the terrific registration system that they have, and the records, you know, that go back, and the breed associations and the big breed hunts of the 70s and 80s and into the 90s. Huge Walker days, black and tan days, blue tick English. Plot and Redbone, you know, those were, you know, great times, great gatherings of lots and lots of people. And, you know, UKC, because of their records, I believe, has been, I don't think anybody will argue with me that they have not been the leading registry or keeper of records for coonhounds, going all the way back to 1898. But Jarvis Umphers, whom we've spoken of here many, many times, and of course has passed on now, was a very ardent UKC hunter. He was always at Autumn Oaks. His dogs were up there when they took the pictures on Sunday morning as, you know, Grand Night champions and night champions and all. And Jarvis had some great dogs, but he got the idea. I think it was about 1973 or four that he started what was called the Professional Coon Hunters Association.
Wow.
PCA.
Well, you know, it was pretty, it was an interesting event for me to help out with. Our clubs held that event on behalf of PKC for several years now. I think this was the third year that it was held at our club in Greenville. And, you know, I can't say that I have a ton of experience with PKC hunts in general. You know, I'm a hunt director with PKC and I've administered their events before and I've hunted in them, but nothing, not any major events, not any bigger hunts. And, being able to kind of sit back and watch the Pennsylvania State Championship take place was interesting. I actually really liked the way that they, conduct the state hunt on Saturday. For those of you who don't know, when you compete in a state championship event, a PKC state championship event, they hunt off the top 16 dogs in that particular state from the year prior. So dogs compete all year long to earn money to be in these standings. And then the top 16 are gathered and they're hunted off for the state championship. Now, with Pennsylvania specifically, I think in the last several years, they've had a top 16, obviously, but they haven't had those 16 individual dogs all show up to the same place at the same time. So in this particular situation, they had to pull from below the top 16. And I'm telling you, a full blown Cinderella story happened over the weekend at the state championship event. We had a dog that was owned by Rocky Peace.
I thought you were going to say somebody came to the hunt in a carriage made out of a pumpkin and had a dog box. Oh.
I don't think Rocky's driving a pumpkin around, but. Rocky Peace of Pennsylvania. He's a pretty well-known handler. He's probably most known for his success with the Lone Pine Rebel dog. Okay. Rocky came to the hunt because he was ranked number 32 in the state, which he would have been the very last dog to fill a spot had they had one available. And sure enough, just the way that everything played out, he got a spot to hunt in the hunt off for the state championship. And believe it or not, his dog went on to win the entire kit and caboodle. I couldn't believe it. I thought that was so cool.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
Well, you know, PKC, just for the guys that may not know the way that PKC operates, you know, they have various entry fees and they publish a chart of awards in their blue book for each entry fee level so that the hunt directors and all know how much to send to PKC, how much to keep for the club, how much is going to go into the escrow account, which is something that PKC has always had and is a means by which they fund a lot of their state championships, breed championships, national championship, and so forth, because they put a little money out of every entry fee back into an escrow for, it might be a state escrow, it may be a breed association, it may be for the youth, it may be, you know, any number of things. But I wanted to read real quickly, just go over a chart here just to show kind of how that works. Now, if I can push the magic button, I'm looking at a chart for a $105 open event.
Okay.
Okay. So, and the columns on this chart are entries, proceeds, which is, you know, how many dogs times $105. That's the overall proceeds for the event. what the total awards will be, what the club will receive, what PKC will receive to keep their lights on and so forth, and the escrow that's going to be tucked away for the championship or whatever down the road, and then the awards that are going to be paid individually to the dogs that place first through fourth and then cast winners if you have that many. So let's say that the average hunt out there, let's say, has 10 dogs. We'll make this simple.
That's a perfect number to choose because we had the night before the actual state championship at the club, we had an open event, which I think most state championships are going to do. They had an open event with a $105 entry fee and 10 dogs.
There you go. Well, the proceeds, 10 times $105 is $1,050. So $550 of that amount is set aside for the awards to pay to the winners. The club is going to net $220. PKC will receive $150. The escrow account will receive $130. And then if the dogs hunt it off for first, second, and third place, it would be 303 for first, 154 for second, and 94 for third. That's what you would be paid. And that would go on your dog's record. Okay. And everything, all the titles and all in PKC are based on dollars earned. But if you decide to split that rather than hunt it off, each of those three cast winners would receive $183.
Yep.
So that's the way it works. And it depending, of course, the more dogs you have, the more money, the more the better chance you have to win. So but anyway, go ahead.
Oh, being said, what is there's an age old debate that goes on about whether hunters should or shouldn't hunt for money, number one, but the major preference between hunting for money and not hunting for money. So as somebody who is not a money hunter by trade and somebody who needs to learn a lot more about the other side of the sport, what is the allure to hunting for money and why are these guys so crazy about it?
Really?
Are you still there, Steve?
It's money. It's money. Well, you know, it's interesting because I was deeply ingrained in the UKC culture, let's call it that, of the past. And when I had the opportunity to go to PKC at the request of Larry Meeks, when I want to pause here real quick. I saw a disturbing message on Facebook this week that Larry Meeks, who was the owner of PKC in the years that I worked there and who purchased the registry from Jarvis Humphers and later sold it to Roger Dale Carnegie, who's the owner and CEO now. But anyway, Larry posted that he has been battling cancer. And unfortunately, we never like to hear that about our friends. Thankfully, cures are coming at an impressive rate. And a lot of people are actually beating that. We have another prominent coon hunter, Judas Bowling, that is battling cancer right now. So, you know, those of you who are people of faith, say a prayer for Larry.
Absolutely.
I think he went into remission, and now he's having to undergo some further chemo treatments and so forth. And I know that he appreciates your prayer. Larry is a man of faith. I got to know Larry and his family, Rita and their children and all, very well when I was at PKC. And they're like family to me, and I want to send out, as you say, those good thoughts and those prayers to the man upstairs that Larry will get through this and be back at him. He's a coon hunter, and he knows coon dogs, but, man, does he know trucks. That guy, I've been many a time with Larry. We'd be out somewhere at a hunt or something, and he said, I got to check on this trailer up here. And we pull off the side of the road, and he's up under a trailer crawler, a semi-trailer. I mean, I know that he could be like Johnny Cash and build one piece at a time, you know, because that truck's running his blood. But anyway, Larry, partner, we hope that you're feeling better, and we send best wishes for you. And the same thing for Judas Bowling. Judas, get up out of that hospital, man. Get back out here and hunt with us.
Amen to that.
Yeah. But you talked about PKC and the differences. Is that how I got on that rabbit path, which I thought was...
You need me to reframe the question for you?
Yeah, reel me back in there just a minute.
Okay. Well, you know, being a pretty staunch UKC guy myself, I haven't been the kind of guy to chase after money as far as hunting for. Yeah. So my question to you, having the experience that you do with the PKC registry itself and the culture that surrounds these types of hunts, what is the allure to hunting for money? Why are these guys chasing the money? Why are these guys so active and professional in hunting for it?
Well, let's hear your thoughts. Anything else in competition coon hunting, no matter what the award is, recognition's the name of the game. Somebody dropped a set out of the ring, I think.
I think so.
No, I mean, we do this for the recognition we get, whether we're getting our name called after all the scorecards are in, whether it's to walk, march up and carry one of those big four-poster trophies with a clock, or it's to go to the pay window and get some Benjamins to stuff into the gas tank. It's all about the recognition, number one. I think there's no fundamental difference between a PKC hunter, or let's say a money hunter, because there's other organizations that hunt for money as well. You know, when I went to AKC, we made it optional. The club could do the type of awards that they wanted. So that number one, I think recognition's the big thing. But there came a time back in the day, and again, Jarvis Humphers is the guy that kind of changed, that turned the tide, that guys were saying, man, I can't eat those trophies. My wife complains about their dust catchers. And I've got a bazillion of them in the basement or the garage or whatever. And it's kind of funny, you know, when guys start hunting for money and they start bringing the money home, the spouses all of a sudden get interested in coon hunting.
That's an understatement.
Yeah. But no, I think it's just the fact that, hey, you know, I can go have a good time. And I can put a few dollars. But the main thing is I can put those dollars on a board, on a leaderboard. And they can be read by my fellow hunters and see that, like, Fever for now, with just under $400, is leading the plot race. You look at the state of Florida, I think he's like number 7 in the state of Florida. But the dog in first place has got $4,000, you know. So we got a ways to go.
Sure.
But it's that. It's the lure of the recognition. It's the lure of the money that can be applied to next week's entry or whatever.
Yeah.
A guy once told me he was on the way to becoming a PKC millionaire. I said, oh, yeah? And he said, yeah, I'm spending $80 to win $60.
So, okay, so So that being said, as a UKC guy, I know that there exists certain stereotypes around the types of hunters and the types of dogs that compete at PKC events, just like there are stereotypes of the kind of dogs that compete at UKC events and the kind of guys that prefer those types of events. So what, if any, what are some of the stereotypes that exist when you're talking about, like, what can I expect if I go to take my dog to a PKC hunt? You know, as far as the dogs and the hunters are what do you think?
Well, if you want to be frank,
I have some commentary on that, but I want to hear your thoughts.
You know, well, you're going to hear all kinds of things, and you're not going to hear them as much now as you did back in the day when I broke in. Okay, your UKC dog is a backpacker. He doesn't want to get by himself. He's a hitchhiker. He's going to be treed behind the other dogs. Okay, that's one. Mm-hmm. All right. On the other side of the fence, all those PKC dogs are all mean. You know, they're fighters.
Well, I think it goes
on and on. There's all kinds of those stereotypes. None of them will hold water. None of them. But it's, you know, it's clubhouse chatter that people like to toss around.
Well, I think for me, coming into it in my teenage years, I think that a big stereotype that you saw as far as the dogs are concerned, a lot of the dogs that were competing in PKC events were thought to be finished Grand Night champions from the other side. So what that meant was, if you were going to go to a PKC hunt, you were going to hunt against some pretty fine animals and dogs that had been there and done that and maybe had some of the bad behaviors that you wouldn't want to see at a UKC hunt. So I can remember at that particular time hearing all the about the mean dogs and all that kind of stuff, and you had to put spiked collars on your dogs to to run them in a PKC hunt. But I never found that the case. I never did. And you know, if I can just commentate on what I saw this weekend, what I was really impressed with was I guided on Friday night, which was the open event, $105 entry fee hunt. It's just a warm up hunt. You know, it allows the club to make a little extra money and people to come in and hunt before the actual state championship. But I guided a 3-dog cast on Friday night, and I believe 2 of them were eligible to hunt in the state hunt the next day. But anyways, I was kind of expecting, you know, the old adage that these dogs were going to blow out in 3 cardinal different directions, and we were going to need a lot of ground to hunt these dogs. And I think it was an hour and a half cast or something to that effect. So, you know, I had a couple spots lined up. And I'll tell you what, we got into that first woods and we turned loose and we ended up treeing 6 coons in under an hour. And we didn't cover a 500-yard circle. These dogs were split treeing and they were just hunting right around each other. And we did a ton of walking. Don't get me wrong. I probably walked about 3 miles, but I didn't cover 500 yards in that whole time period. So, that's just an example that really blew any kind of stereotype you can have surrounding the PKC dog or the PKC hunt kind of out of the water. But it was a really good experience for sure.
Well, I think there's been a lot more interaction between the PKC and the UKC hunters down through the years. And, you know, the more things change, the more they stay the same. You see that UKC has kind of followed suit with their slam events and various money events. Pro Sport comes along and they kind of are like the PKC hunters. They're hunting for money, but they are catering to the guys that can dig a little deeper down that back pocket and come out with a handful of those Benjamins. And you know, they kind of, well, what comes to mind, you know, PKC has their truck events, their truck hunts, they call them, where they, well, I'm getting ahead of myself. PKC has always been built on races, the leaderboards in various categories, state leaderboards, breed leaderboards, sire of the year, dam of the year, pup of the year, national championship qualification, all these different things that they run all year long that keeps people engaged.
Sure.
You know?
Yeah.
And that has been great. Along comes Pro Sport and says, well, why should you run around all over the country trying to get a pup ticket so you can go down to the casino, as it was for many years, and hunt for a truck when you can just come use that money that you're putting in the gas tank every other night to go to a hunt somewhere. Just put that money in one pile, enter a Pro Sport hunt, and if you win it, you get a truck. Mm-hmm. So they kind of changed the complexion of the truck hunts quite a bit, although PKC's truck hunts are still very popular. But back in the day when I was involved with PKC, we had pup derbies and guys, you know, were hunting these nice young pups and quite honestly hunting them too much.
Yeah.
And burning them out trying mm-hmm. to achieve these tickets, you know, to go to. But
not to interrupt you, Steve, but no. where did the idea for hunting for a truck come from? Like, obviously it makes sense, but you know, I don't know that you necessarily see that in any other type of competitive dog event or any other kind of competitive event in general. So where did that come from?
Well, it came from Jarvis Umpers. Jarvis was the first one at the PKC World Hunt, or maybe it was the National Championship. I don't remember. But he offered, House's Lipper, for instance, okay. I think won the first truck that PKC gave away. And it was a Ford Ranger. And Tom Hopkins, who owned Lipper before selling him to, well, he and Joe House, you know, owned him together, I think, at one time and all. But Tom was the first guy to win a truck. And then Junior Lassiter, who has passed away, was first one to win a truck with a bench show win at the, I guess, the national championship. So it was Jarvis. But those trucks were kind of you got a 6-month lease on it, okay. I think. And then at the end of the 6 months, you could buy it or turn it back in. So we'll have to get Tom on here and let him educate us on that a little better. Yeah. But no, it was Jarvis. Jarvis was the first one. And then when we started the UKC Winter Classic down in Albany, Georgia, we gave a truck away to the hunt winner. And it was a Toyota truck from Rob McCauley there in Nicholasville, Kentucky. And it was a lease situation, too, where they got, I think it was a 6-month lease. But then through the escrows and all, and I mentioned last week, we were talking about this a little bit, those hunts at the casino where, you know, if you got a ticket to the Nationals, and the way you do that is by, you know, being a breed champion or a state champion or winning, you know, being in the top tier, and I don't remember the exact numbers of, excuse me, in the top tier of one of these national races, you get invited to the national championship. And the national championship, to me, has always been the hardest hunt, the most prestigious hunt in PKC, because nobody is there that hasn't already won a state race or a breed race or some kind of major race. So that, you know, always put the national high on my list. I was talking the other day to somebody, and I think it was Alan Bridges in Georgia, and I were talking about this. It was just yesterday, about this recent Peach Classic, and a dog that he bred got two cast wins. I think was the only dog to have two cast wins at that event. And we were talking, and I said, well, you know, if we were to win, we're invited because Fever placed second last year in the plot race. We're invited to go to the plot championship, which they always hold one of those each year for each breed. But I said, the escrow is so small, it's not worth driving all the way to Flora, Illinois, to try to win the plot championship. He said, oh, no, no. You win that plot championship, you got a ticket to the nationals. Well, you can win $30,000. And the old man, you know, the light came back on. I said, well, yeah, that's right.
So you kind of explain to the audience what would be the carrot that you would be chasing by competing in your breed and your state race. I would assume that state race winners are the same way, that they would get a ticket to the national championship as well. Mm-hmm. Okay. So that's pretty cool, because then there's representation, right? So not only do you have some of the best dogs in the country, but you have a representative of each breed. You have a representative from potentially every state where a state race is being conducted. So that's some lore right there. I mean, that would drive anybody to want to compete in their breed or state race. Mm-hmm. So that's pretty cool.
Yeah. One of the major differences in PKC and like UKC in the past is that, you know, UKC, you go to the World Hunt. Well, you go through the zones, and if you make it to the finals, then you got to win to advance. At PKC, you know, they've always given you, well, in my day, it was four chances. You started on Monday night if you wanted to start that early. But you had four nights that you needed to put two cast wins together in the same night, win early and win late. And if you did, you advanced to the semifinals on Friday night. And then you could advance on to the final four ultimately. So that sweetened the pot. You know, my buddy Jamie Perrin down in Alabama said, we're just pot builders, you know. But you go, the more entries and more times the guys re-enter, that goes all in the awards package, you know.
Does a dog or an individual owner of a dog, I should say, do they have the option, even after they've doubled up, to continue hunting that same dog?
No. Once you've qualified, then you're in the finals and you can go back to motel.
So there's no potential for them blocking other people
to potentially advance. I learned when I went to PKC right away, one thing I noticed, man, those guys drive some nice trucks. And another thing I noticed, and I've said this many times, was the attitude around the entry tables and stuff after the hunt. Guys walk in, how'd you do, Corey? I got beat.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Yep. So let's get a cup of coffee, sit down, listen to the stories. How'd you do, Corey? I got lucky.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, that was basically it, you know. And it ain't bragging if you can do it, right?
Right, right.
So there's nothing wrong with the bragging, but those guys were just the most nonchalant about the wins, you know.
Well, I'll tell you what I noticed over the weekend at the state championship. The guys that didn't win their cast, they weren't there. Or they weren't there.
They
very
went
long.
Home from the woods.
Yeah.
When they got back to the truck, they shook the winner's hand, signed the scorecard. See ya.
Well, you know how it is when you're sitting around in a clubhouse, you know, waiting for cast to come back, and that front door to the clubhouse opens. You're gauging people's the way their swagger, the way they walk in. You're trying to figure out who won that cast without even seeing the scorecard. You know, I didn't have to guess at the PA state championship because the guy that walked in that was holding the card, he won the cast.
He was there the winner.
Nobody was coming in behind him.
That's right. He was it. Oh, man, the days of Aurora, Kentucky, there's a guy named Wesley Sanford from Kentucky. He had the hardwood Elvis attack.
Okay, yeah. I remember seeing studies.
Wesley would come in the clubhouse if old Elvis won the cast. Wesley was wearing an Elvis suit.
No,
an Elvis impersonator.
That's literally an
and
Elvis
he would
attack.
Come. Thank you very much.
Jeez. But you know, it definitely is a different atmosphere. I think you brought up a good point in your observation of that. You know, I think UKC events have always been kind of roundhouse family type gatherings where, you know, the old timers come out and they hang out and they tell stories and maybe they're not hunting, maybe they're not guiding, but they're going to stick around to see who wins, you know? PKC hunts are definitely, I don't want to say more professional, but the people who are there take it very seriously and they've got other stuff going on in their lives that will drag them back home rather than coming back to the clubhouse to hang out.
Yeah. Well, so the one exception to that in PKC was the world championship at Aurora, Kentucky.
Okay.
Because those old guys were in there hanging around, telling the stories and all. And I think that's what endeared that place to so many people. Was that it did have that old feel, you know.
Now, for context, what span of time are you referring to, like between what year and what year?
Okay, I'm not sure when they started the World Hunt at Aurora.
Is Aurora considered land? Is that their land between
it's
the
right
lakes?
It's right by the land between the lakes, yeah. There are two lakes there, Lake Barkley and Kentucky Lake.
Okay.
And land between the lakes is in between, okay?
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah. And then Aurora is on the west side of Kentucky Lake. And
year it started there, but the year that you finished having anything to do with that war, it ceased to be there was what year?
Oh, okay. I left PKC in 2004 to go to AKC. It was in November, right after the World Hunt. That was at the World Hunt in Aurora that I made my decision that I was going to go to AKC. It stayed there for a few years, and then they had some really bad storms came through there and blew all the timber down and just really wrecked the hunting around there. Oh, and wow. I don't know if it's recovered yet or not.
Yeah.
So that would have been somewhere in the mid-2000s, and I don't know exactly. I was there from 98 to 2004 were the years that those four. Actually, it was 7 years.
Okay.
That I was with PKC. But it had been there quite a while before that.
Yeah. Sure. Yeah. And what made Aurora, Kentucky an excellent location for an event that size was the distribution of public land that was available through the national park system?
Well, that's part of it. Okay. The land between the lakes was there, and that's – I don't know, is that 20,000 or 40,000 acres? I'm not sure. I'd have to go back and see, but it's a sizable chunk of land.
Mm-hmm.
The clubs, there were several clubs around there. Clinton, Kentucky, where Ronnie Bones Club, that's where Joe House lived, you know, when he had House's chief. And you know, he'd say, come down to where the rivers meet, the Ohio and the Mississippi.
Right.
And hunt with these dogs. And that was all part of our history. And then there was, you know, clubs all over. There were clubs at Camden, Tennessee, down on the interstate near Parsons, where the St. Jude hunt is held. And then there was a hunt, there was clubs at Cady's and Smithland, and I don't know, Paducah. There's so many different clubs in that area. So there was an ample supply of guides there. Now, nobody, I think, would argue that Salem, where the PKC hunt is now, has better coon hunting than West Kentucky. No question about it. You know, it's easier, it's flatter, there's more coon. For many years, you know, the mecca for coon hunters for me is Flora, Illinois. You know, and Flora's only 20 miles or so east of Salem, where they are now. So, but that tennis center, that large facility, that's a clay court tennis building where they hold matches and all that. And it's on Ken Lake State Park, which is, you know, state land. It's a state park. They have a lodge. They have cabins. So you can stay on the park itself or in the little town of Aurora, which is just a little tourist town, like a mini Gatlinburg, mini Gatlinburg.
Very many.
They had a lot of cabins, tourist cabins they used to be called, and they were old, and they were not fancy. But guys would go out all around the lakes there and rent mobile homes and things that people had for summer homes. You know, the Aurora, as a fishing town, a tourist town, was all closed down by the time the World Hunt got there in October.
Sure.
So coon hunters had the whole place. You know?
Wow.
So there was ample places to stay, and that was a big draw.
Yeah.
So, it was something that I wish every coon hunter could have had on their resume.
Honestly, that's Aurora's one place that I would like to go just to hunt and experience, kind of, you know, just because of the history behind that area mm-hmm. and what it's done for coon hunting in the past.
Yeah.
That's an area that I would really enjoy going to hunt along with some others. But you know, that's some good history that I don't think a lot of people will know. So I appreciate you, you know, kind of diving into that a little bit.
Yeah, they had an absolutely fantastic host club. I think it was called Twin Lakes Coon Hunters. Danny Hamby, Grant Black, Jimmy Russell, all those guys there from that area. You know, they were just super guys to work with, you know. And they were there sitting behind the desk with the UKC people. You know, the thing about Aurora is you'd go in that building at about 11 o'clock before lunch, and you would walk out of there about 3:30 or 4 a.m. in the morning for 10 days in a row.
Yeah, I can imagine that.
So, but it was fun times.
Next question. Let's go back to talking about the dogs, the PKC dogs, mm-hmm. if we can call them that. So obviously, you have seen firsthand a lot of PKC dogs in action, I would say.
Oh, yeah.
So for somebody that might be thinking about dipping their toe into the PKC world and the hunts they have to offer, what is one consistent thing that you've seen across all of the major winners in PKC events? What's one consistent trait that you notice that they have that might set them apart from the winners of a major UKC event, or just the type of dog that would win at a UKC event versus a PKC event? What do you think that particular trait would be?
Larry Meeks, we mentioned before,
mm-hmm.
said the success of PKC depends on good dogs.
Wow.
And what he meant by that is you're not going to come and pay entry fees and lose week after week after week with a mediocre dog and be a PKC hunter.
Sure.
So the number one thing that I would say in PKC is good dogs. Dogs, and some of them are those dogs that went through the ranks in UKC.
Sure.
The independence in the dogs has come along in recent years, and I can't lay that on PKC over UKC or anything else. I think that's been a matter of the training methods of some people mm-hmm. that consistently hunted that independent type dog. And I do believe for a period of time, and I believe this is changing, for a period of time, those were man-made independent dogs.
Well, I think you hit the nail on the head right there. Man-made. Yep. Yeah, you know, I remember when I was competition hunting mid-2000s, you know, there was a big push from a lot of the guys that I hunted with to try and make their dogs more independent than what they naturally were. And I actually got one of the best dogs that I ever had because of what his owners classified as lack of independence.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, I think that you're right. I think that that isn't something that can be strapped solely on the back of PKC as far as bringing that to the forefront of our genetics. I think on a more macro scale, that's the serious competition hunters that have brought that into
yes.
existence and brought that out in our genetics. And I don't necessarily think it's a bad thing. I think that it can.
It is when you're 77 years old.
I knew he was going to bring that up. I can hear his knees cracking from here.
That's right.
Well, that was like this weekend, for example. You know, those dogs were completely independent. We scored 7 coons in a very small area in an hour and a half. You know, there's nothing wrong with that kind of independence.
Questions. Did you okay. have 2 dogs on any tree during the hunt?
Once.
One time.
We had the initial tree that was scored had a coon. We recut that dog with another dog that had just been declared treed. We scored that second dog, and when we turned that second dog loose, the first dog got treed again, and that second dog did go in and back that dog, and that was the only tree that we scored 2 dogs on the entire night.
Isn't that amazing?
It is amazing.
That is how it is almost any night across the country now.
Yeah,
the dogs are not together, and. Okay, let's look at this little plot dog we mentioned earlier, and I don't mean to ever make this podcast an advertisement for him because we're not selling anything off of it. But anyway, he was naturally independent.
Mm-hmm.
His mother was. That's all that was. She was a bonehead. I came from the old school. You take a puppy out with an older dog.
Correct.
And let them learn something. And then once they start getting it, then separate them out and start hunting them alone. Nowadays, we hunt these pups alone. He was always hunted alone, you know, mm-hmm. until he was came of age, so to speak. Yeah. So I think
people take for granted the fact that independence is how we got our coonhounds to begin with. Because and this is going back to the colonial age.
Yeah.
Colonists to America were very interested in fox hunting. you know, because of their English roots. And they brought over with them foxhounds, and they didn't know about their innate abilities to tree game. They didn't know that they had individuals in their packs that would peel off and tree coons or do any of that.
Well, they didn't have coons for one thing.
Well, right, exactly. So, you know, it's good to have natural independence in your dogs, and it's good to reward that. What Steve and I are saying is there's a point where it becomes too much, and that can be dangerous.
I've spoken about a plot female that I had. My friend and I raised this litter, and it was very tightly bred. This was a half-brother, half-sister cross, something I wouldn't normally do. But as a compromise to my buddy, Mike Cawley, I said, no, I won't let you breed your female to her littermate brother, but I will let you breed to her half-brother. And that's how we got this cross. And this female, Annie, I've spoken of her in the past. I believe if you turned every dog on the grounds at Autumn Oaks down the creek, Annie would go up the creek. She was that independent her whole life, naturally. Never, you know. But she got to the point that when she would tree a coon, and she could tree them, believe me, and another dog covered her, she'd leave it.
Yep.
She didn't want anything to do with another dog. Now, that was reinforced by drawing a couple of dogs that pinched her ears on the trees. Mm-hmm. And she just absolutely didn't want anything to do. But I'm amazed as I watch these videos, and of course I've walked on casts many times, final casts in UKC, PKC, and AKC, and seen independence in the dogs. I always saw a degree of independence in those real good dogs that mm-hmm. won those world championships. But I did see dogs that, if they needed to, they would tree with another dog. We had an old say. Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say that, and that's probably something that a lot of people in the history of competition coon hunting have kind of taken for granted, because, you know, those dogs that display what you're talking about, that kind of natural independence, they might have been at the forefront of the race most of the time, and had the ambition to go and find the game and run it, and so they probably led quite a bit, you know. So I would think that a lot of even the UKC dogs that were winning back in the day, when you had more of a calling contest for strike points, mm-hmm. I think that there was probably a great deal of independence there as well.
The old saying with the mushers, the sled dog, you know, unless you're the lead dog, the view never changes. You know?
Yeah, that's kind of the point I'm trying to make. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah, and I was so fortunate all those years to hunt with some really nice dogs in those final fours. You know, I remember a time or two at the final fours where I thought there was some dogs in the cast that I wondered how they got there. Mm-hmm. But for the most part, they were all good hounds.
Did you have a favorite? A favorite major PKC winner that you hunted with?
Hmm.
Putting them on the spot.
I hunted with the dog on the final cast the night that he won it. And I've spoken to that hunt before. But what really endeared me to this dog and was when they brought him to Michigan in February, when all the swamps were frozen over, and we turned him loose seven times and he treed seven coons.
Oh, my gosh.
The hunt, I believe, was 2000.
Okay.
I'm going to have to double check. And the dog I'm speaking of is Daryl Newton's Silver Dollar Stone. dog.
Oh, interesting
choice. It was out of a dog called Rock River Stone. Beautiful tricolor walker dog.
Yeah.
That cast, and I spoke of it, and I'll be brief, went down to the final tree. There was a dog named Stylish Oz on the cast. Kevin Turner, who has now passed away, was Buzz Lynch's partner on Oz. And they treed together on this last tree. Scotty Engel was on the cast hunting Russ Bellers and female. The judge had to go. Ann was split treed. He went to her with her. Kevin Roberson was the judge. We sat at this tree, sat on a log, waiting for the judge to come back and score it. If the tree is scored plus, Oz will be the world champion. If it's scored circle or minus, Silver Dollar Stone will be the world champion. And we sat there for, I think it was close to 40 minutes, because Ann was really deep, and she'd been treed right at the end, and she couldn't win, as I recall. Now, I don't, Scotty will have to remind me about this, because I can't remember exactly. But anyway, the pressure was there. When we came back, they worked the tree, the solid, I think at that time was 8 minutes, 10 minutes.
Okay.
And it was a den tree. It was obviously hollow. But they kept trying to get a coon to look, or squall a coon out, or beat on the tree, pull vine, all these things. That to me was a coon dog. He really did. But he didn't really stand out as being a dominant dog that night on that final cast. And there were others. Trying to think of ones that went right down to the wire that I really enjoyed. But there were so many, Corey. I can't really place my finger on it. But many times that I didn't get to go to the woods with the final four, I did. I was in the room, and many times awarded that big trophy. Mm-hmm. And on some occasions, I was standing behind the camera. The Mr. Smith dog that Larry Weaver had, that Don Dunlap hunted.
Buck Creek AKs, Mr. Smith.
Yes.
Okay.
Dominated a cast of two good females at Chillicothe, and then went down to Newberry, South Carolina, and won it again. He won the AKC World twice. Mm-hmm. Very impressive dog.
Wow.
So, you know, there were a lot. Just making the Final Four was an honor, you know, those dogs. And in my view, they deserve to be there, you know.
So, with all the talking that we've done about PKC and some of the different things, about stereotypes and all that kind of stuff. You know, it reminds me that a lot of times when you get into these debates about the different registries and what they have to offer and why they do things the way they do, people want to talk about the negative. They want to talk about how PKC, the Super Stakes program, has ruined, you know, the breeding programs of many a man or whatever. What are some positive things that you think PKC has done for the world of coonhounds and the like? Let's talk about some good stuff.
Yeah, well, for one thing, the atmosphere. PKC was the registry that introduced the midweek hunt.
Yeah.
And that enabled a lot more guys to be able to participate in competition hunting by going out and hunting for an hour and getting back home by 10 o'clock and being able to get up and go to work the next day.
Yeah.
So, you know, to me, that was a real positive. I think the conduct, not certainly that there weren't some bad eggs along the way, but the conduct, the sportsmanship. I believe when I went to PKC was maybe. I don't want to diss the UKC Hunters, but it was probably a cut above.
Mm-hmm.
You know, not so many egregious situations. But, you know, I've always been a promoter of competition coon hunting, so I haven't tried to dwell too much on the negative. I've often thought I could write a book that would be interesting. A lot of people would love to hear all these stories, but they're negative, and right. They don't do anything to build a sport, and mm-hmm. they don't do. But I think I think the integrity of PKC has been very high. You know, there was an old feeling that if a guy will fight you for a $2 trophy, he'll cut your throat for money.
Yeah.
You know, these kind of comments. And, you know, I didn't find that to be true at all. I found a great deal of respect between the hunters in PKC. Because if I cheat you in PKC, it's the same thing as reaching in your back pocket, pulling your wallet out, and taking two or three 20s out of it. Well, I'm taking your money.
Yeah.
Okay?
That's an interesting way of putting it.
You know, and I always looked at it that way, and I saw that the guys, there was a different, I won't say a higher, but I'd say there was a different degree of respect among the PKC hunters when I went there.
Sure.
And I'm sure that still exists. You know, the registries really don't push or publish their barred individuals list anymore.
Yeah.
And, you know, there's all kinds of situations down through the years. Boys will be boys, I guess. But no, those were positive things. I think that they brought coon hunting, PKC, may have been responsible up until lately, where UKC has come on strong with the TOC and all these things, and their media department and all mm-hmm. the positive things they're doing has brought coon hunting to center stage. But I think PKC did a little more of that, you know.
Sure.
You went to Aurora, the awards, the stage was huge. Flowers yeah. everywhere, banners everywhere, presentations. You know, we had the youth hunt, and I had all the kids lined up at the back door. And as they walked in with their dogs, George Strait was on the PA system singing, "Dad, this may be the best day of my life." Yeah. You know, we did all these. But to say, we did that at UKC too. You know, yeah. we had rodeo parades at the American Heritage Hunt. At AKC, we had the national championship in Greensboro and had a guy jump out of a plane with the American flag. I mean, you know,
I never heard that one.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Big flag.
Oh, my
But and I'm thinking, if this guy gets killed, whew,
yeah.
I'm good.
Bye-bye, fielder.
yeah. But, well, no, you know, I think PKC has been definitely – all the registries have done their part, but PKC has definitely been a positive impact on
yeah.
the sport of coon hunting.
No well, I'll tell you what, I think the most convicting thing you said, or at least what grabbed my attention the most, was the analogy you made about reaching into somebody's – you know, if you were going to cheat somebody in a PKC hunt, it would be the equivalent of reaching into their back pocket and taking yeah. a couple 20s. Like, you know, I never really thought of it that way. And I guess if I had to, you know, give my perspective on it, you know, the idea of hunting for money was always one of, you know, it's going to attract more people who are more willing to do what it takes to get the money, right? So mm-hmm. I kind of looked at it as
it didn't
from a negative
work out. Yeah. And yeah. being on the other side of the fence, you would tend to do that.
Mm-hmm.
I
sure.
did not find that to be true.
Well, that's good.
Yeah. In fact, some of the, you know, Russ Meyer out in Missouri, Jess Dickerson's friend, they held an invitational out there. And, you know, the guys, the real cream of the crop handlers, not mm-hmm. only the fact that they knew how to handle a dog, but they were a strong moral character, too. You know, they were good
sure.
sportsmen. They were good people. Well, and those, you know, and I found a lot of that, and they're there in UKC just the same.
Well, and I think if I can kind of draw on my initial observations about PKC, you know, like I said earlier about it, PKC being full of more experienced dogs, you're probably going to have more experienced people involved with a PKC event than what you would with a UKC event. At least the way that it used to be was UKC was really the introductory program that most people were going to participate with in any capacity.
Exactly.
PKC is more of an expansion on your horizons as far
it's
as
a what's graduate program.
That's a good way of putting it. Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
Yeah. And you did. I did find that right away. Mm-hmm. You know, these guys, most of the guys that I met at PKC were coon hunters.
Yeah.
They were coon hunters.
So they, with that, there's an added degree of professionalism or just competition.
There was for sure. But I think there's been a lot of inbreeding, let's say, or interaction between the registries with the changes, you know, and I think a lot of that is what UKC's done with their Tournament of Champions program. And now they've announced this year, and I haven't seen too much about what's going on with that, but I know at Autumn Oaks they announced these new slam type hunts for more money for smaller groups of people that wanted to go to a next level and so forth. And
I think they call them pro slams. I think that's pro slams. The word they're using. Actually, I think if I'm not mistaken, the deadline for TOC is tonight. Am I wrong on that?
You know, it could be. I think, I believe that's right. I think it's midnight tonight. But of course, this is coming out a week later, unfortunately.
We're not trying to give anybody false hope here.
if you weren't there by March 11th at 11:59 p.m., then TOC is not going to be in your future this year.
I will say, as much as I've never been a money hunter, I think that it's exciting to see the new landscapes that a lot of these registries are breaking into. And I think it's exciting to see the direction that coon hunting's going. I think it's exciting to see the media coverage, the new media coverage that a lot of these events are getting. It's good. And I think that in a way it really illustrates that the sport's growing. It's not dwindling away. There's not a fear of it going by the wayside like a lot of people think, or a lot of people say at least.
Yeah, I read the post this past weekend. Now, listeners, keep in mind this is going to be two weekends for you, about the South Carolina State Championship. And Ray Conrad, who owns Bright Eyes Lights, has always been engaged with the coonhound community. I worked with Ray when I was at AKC. I mean, he's been very past president of the American Black and Tan Association. He's always, besides selling a light to coon hunters, he's also been very much engaged in the sport and has done a lot of good. Really have high respect for Ray. But yeah, anyway, absolutely. He was doing the reporting on this South Carolina State Championship. And the entries were really strong. You know, they had really strong entries. And you think if you're getting 70, 80 dogs or something at a hunt nowadays, the sport's not dead. Will it ever be back to the numbers of the early 80s when I broke into when I broke into the UKC office, but I didn't do that.
Don't incriminate yourself.
The sport is doing very well, and I'm I'm excited to see what's going on with it.
Me really too. Am.
Well, Corey, we've chewed up almost an hour and 20 minutes.
My gosh.
Can you believe that?
Yeah. Well, I'm supposed to keep Steve in check, but there's nobody here to keep me in check. So, but I really appreciate you taking the time to kind of educate me on this side of the sport that I'm not as familiar with. Because, you know, as many things as I know, and my wife will tell you, I know a lot.
I do too, but I just can't remember all of it.
There's a lot of things I don't know about. And this is one in particular, you know, anything that has to do with BKC is definitely not my territory. So I appreciate you being willing to, you know, chew on that bone for a while.
Well, another thing, and I'll throw it in here just really quickly. First of all, I would say that we could have had guests and brought in guests that are, you know, PKC diehards that could have done a much better job of explaining what PKC is and how it works than I, because I've been away from there a long time. Sure. 2004, that's 20 years since I was at PKC. But anyway, one of the things that I think PKC did on the positive side, and I'll mention it briefly, was the panel system for settling disputes. It works very well. If you see it in action, see it the way they're conducted, there's a protocol that they go through with it and all. Does everybody always agree with the panel decision? No. There is an appeal system that a process that you can go through. But that was one of the things. And the hunt director, where the guy could actually go out and hunt his dog instead of sitting there playing cards with the cook or whatever, he could actually go out and enjoy the hunt himself, and except that he had the responsibility of determining the winners and paying the winners and so forth. But yeah, PKC changed the complexion of competition coon hunting without a doubt. Did it replace UKC? Obviously not. UKC is doing very well. But, and then I think PKC probably created the pattern that pro sport has come along, and then they've added their own touches and are doing very, very well. So we need you all. We need the registries. We need all the organizations. We need all the coon hunters. We need all the kids to have a mentor to take them to the woods. And together, this sport will go forward.
That was beautiful. That really was.
Well, it's my heart, Corey, you know, and I know it's yours too. And that's what we try to portray here on Gone to the Dogs. So, well, folks, I think we have about shined a tree for tonight. What do you think, Corey?
Yeah, I'm satisfied.
Okay. Boy, I bet your wife's never heard you say that you're satisfied with anything.
Probably not.
Well, we're going to bid adieu to our listeners for another week. Want to thank Buddy Woodbury with W Hunting Supply for being the sponsor of this podcast, making it possible for us to be out there on the podcast sphere every week. And we appreciate you, Buddy. If you need anything in the way of hunting supplies for yourself or your dog, W Hunting Supply, DUSupply.com. Corey, that's going to do it, man. I think it's time to, as we used to say, call the dogs, and you probably know what to do to the fire.
Yeah.
So we'll say goodbye for this week, folks. Hope you have a great week. If you're going coon hunting, be safe. And we'll see you next week when Corey Groover and I will be gone to the dogs.
See everybody.